This a little closer.
Okay, good evening. Am I on? I'm just going to have to take it out. Good evening, and welcome to the regularly scheduled October 6th meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board met previously in closed session. We had two items to discuss. We conferred with our labor negotiators regarding our employee groups. It was discussion and direction was given. And we conferred with our real property negotiator regarding the Sheer Edge development in Avila Beach, and direction was given. We are now in open session. Do we have consensus on the order of business? It would appear that we do. Approval of the minutes.
I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes.
We have a motion by Mr. Buckman and a second by Mr. Unger. Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes unanimously. I believe, let's see, the next item is a presentation, the Personnel Commission Annual Report for 2008-2009. Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. As the board is aware, we are a merit system school district, which means that our classified employees are selected and promoted and retained without favoritism or prejudice. And that is overseen also including the classification of all of our classified positions by a personnel commission. I am pleased that this evening we have our chairperson, which is actually the board's member on our personnel commission, here to present to you the 2008-09 annual report. Mr. Kent Taylor.
Thank you, Rick, and good evening, board members.
Good evening.
On behalf of the other two members of our commission, Navjeet Brar and Gail Sears, thank you for allowing me a little time to appear before you and give you the highlights of our commission's activities this last year. You have our report in the agenda packet, so I won't cover it in excruciating detail, but just a couple of highlights. As Rick said, the district employees fall into two main categories, the certified staff and the classified or support staff, and the latter groups is the bailiwick of our commission. San Luis Coastal is a merit system for its classified employees, meaning the recruitment, hiring, and promotion are based on objective criteria. It is a personnel system based on qualifications and abilities, not on contacts. Our job has three main activities that we carry out. And first, they are to establish and periodically revise our written rules and practices that govern our merit system. Additionally, we review and revise the written job descriptions for the approximately 400 employees that are in the classified service. And lastly, we rule on appeals from applicants and from employees. So we have sort of a court function almost when we do that. During this last fiscal year, we reviewed 14 different job classifications affecting 56 employees, or approximately 14% of the classified workforce. As a result of these reviews, we voted to make changes in several of the classifications. Additionally, we held two meetings on CSEA's request for a study of the job description for the special education paraeducator classification. Our staff is attempting to resolve this matter using interest-based bargaining sessions, which may or may not involve changes to the job descriptions. We also revised the personnel rules this last year in three areas. One involved the wording on our regular monthly meetings. One involving our commissioner compensation, which was really just codifying what you folks did in terms of increasing our per diem for our meetings. You did that about 3 years ago, and we're catching up with our and employees not leaving their jobs, and so fewer openings. Nevertheless, the number of regular employees increased from 367 to 399, which seems surprising when you first read it. But this is due to new positions added by the board during the year, and also, probably more importantly, the transfer of the special education employees from the county superintendent of schools offices. For this upcoming year, our goals are essentially the same as last year. We'll have the same basic activities, except we have two additional ones. One is to conduct an annual performance evaluation of the director of personnel, and we've already accomplished that goal this year. And the second is to update the job description for the director of personnel, which has apparently not been updated for some time, so we'll be dealing with that as well. I'd like to close by thanking our director, Rick Robinette, and his excellent staff for their support, their hard work. Without these excellent employees, we would not be an effective commission. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
So my questions got answered.
No questions?
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for serving on the Personnel Commission. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, the next item of business is correspondence. At the time that the agenda was prepared, I don't believe that we had received any correspondence. So now we have public comment, and we do have one comment that needs to be read into the record.
I've been asked to read a comment by Pete Kelly from the Save Our School Committee in Avila Beach. He could not be here tonight and asked that this be read. San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Education, agenda item number 7.
Should I read?
The Avila Save Our School Group has been working with Shear Edge on its lot line adjustment and Phase 1 and Phase 2 concepts since our schoolhouse was deemed historical by the county. Three events have taken place that make us feel all our efforts have been worthwhile. One, the historic schoolhouse will remain where it is and will be restored to its historic condition with a history museum. Number two, San Luis Coastal Unified School District will attain 75% of the initial, quote, blue sky promised by the developer even without Phase 2 development. The new contract with the developer is fair and covering what may or may not happen with Phase 2. And this is by Pete Kelly, Save Our School Committee.
And any other?
Anyone else want to address the board and public comment?
Okay, Mr. Bedrigan, but before you do, we'll read Mr. Kelly's letter in as written. But
it makes more sense when I go to 5-7.
Well, personally, I question, I don't believe that there is a commitment to restoration and the construction of a historical museum, though that may be Mr. Kelly's understanding. Mr. Bedrigan, I'm sorry.
That is good news. That's hello, board, and good evening. It's nice to see our students here, too. That's great to see them providing input. Bruce Bedrigan, President, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association. The San Luis Coastal Teachers Association has trouble understanding why our school board would approve a senior secretary for student services when we have entire departments at our schools without any clerical help. When teachers are taken from their classrooms, to shelve books, to number new books, to label books. That's time that they're missing. They're missing grading their student papers. They're missing doing lesson plans. They're missing that direct contact with the students. Every single administrator has at least one secretary. But our schools, our teachers, who are closest to the students, receive no clerical help. Textbooks, some of our textbooks, not all of them, but some of our textbooks are out of date. Pre-calculus textbooks that date back to 1994 without teacher manuals. We need our trustees to be more informed, but rarely do any trustees visit the 430 San Luis Coastal Teachers Association members or meet with small groups of teachers, counselors, nurses, speech pathologists, or psychologists. Last year, San Luis Coastal Teachers Association suggested some areas for our trustees to look at during their self-evaluation retreat. Unfortunately, we have not heard anything about the outcomes of that process. San Luis Coastal Teachers believe communication is the key to making this district be the district we all know it can be. However, it seems that communication only flows one way. Teachers hope our trustees will be more open to our concerns in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bedrigan. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the board but did not submit a written request? Okay, seeing no one, will move on then. We have reports by student representatives, school staff, and administrators. And we have all three student representatives here tonight. I'm going to have to ask you to flip your name just... That's you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then, shall we just go down? Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll start with Rachel Ayotte from Morro Bay High School.
Hello, my name is Rachel Ayotte, and I am Morro Bay High School's ASB president. And the school year has started off with a bang. We've been very busy. Starting in September the 23rd, we had Club Rush at lunch, which is what ASB puts on, and all the clubs have booths for everyone to sign up. We had a band of a couple boys from our school play, so that was nice. The 25th, we had our first assembly of the year, which was the fall sports assembly. The captains of all the sports teams came down and played a game and did a cheer and boosted morale and school spirit. The 26th, the choir performed during Bravo Slow at the PAC Center at Cal Poly. The 30th, we had our Green Hand initiation for FFA, where all... new incoming FFA students, mostly freshmen, go through a big muddy mess, and that's how they get initiated into FFA. Pretty funny. Football is doing really well. We're 3-1, but we lost our season opener to Napoma last Friday. And next Friday we play Templeton away at 7:30 this Friday, and they're our biggest rival, so that should be a good game. All of our other sports are up and running and doing well as well. In October, our seniors of the month this month are Patrick Kelly and Whitney Linnae. Congratulations to them. Choir and jazz band performed at the Harbor Festival in Morro Bay this past weekend. Thursday, the 22nd, the choir has their fall concert at St. Timothy's Church at 7 o'clock. And the whole enchilada homecoming is coming up. This Friday, we have our mini homecoming assembly, which is where all the nominees from all the classes get to walk and do skits. Be exciting. And then starting next week, the 12th through the 17th is homecoming. Our theme is decades, and Monday is Dress Up 90s Day. Tuesday is Dress 80s Day, and we're having movie night at 7:30 in the old gym, where we'll be watching Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So that should be excellent. And Wednesday is Dress 70s Day, and we're having a carnival at lunch, and we're getting a huge blow-up slide and a bungee run blow-up and sumo suits and a dunk tank. Along with booths that all the clubs have, and the Asian Pacific Club sells really good food, and so it's going to be a great time. And we're having our first powder puff in a couple years at 7 p.m. Wednesday night, and it's $1 with your ASB sticker and $3 for general admission for the rest of the public. And Thursday is Dress 60s Day, and our Final Five Assembly, which is the top 10 seniors for Homecoming King and Queen and the other winners of the underclassmen. And at night we're having a bonfire, which is a pretty fun event. and the royalty dinner for the final five and other winners. That goes on right before the bonfire, and they have a nice dinner. And Friday is Blue and White Day, Dress Blue and White Day. And our homecoming game is against San Ynez, the other Pirates. So that should be a clash. Battle Royale. And the halftime show, of course, when the homecoming king and queen get crowned. And also every day at Nutrition, we're having activities, fun games, and such. And Saturday is the dance where everyone is going to dress in whatever decade outfit they want. So that wraps it up.
What's Powder Puff?
Powder Puff is when junior girls and senior girls play against each other, and we have boy cheerleaders. Yes?
Okay.
The date, it starts the 12th, and it goes through the 17th, which is that Saturday. 16th. Yes.
And the choir concert is the 22nd and 7th at St. Timothy's, and that's in Long Bay, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Next, we have Sandra Sanchez from Pacific Beach High School.
I'm running with Big Brother and Big Sister of San Luis Obispo. This program is designed to help participants receive job skills, training, and career shadowing experiences. The program runs one day a week for 12 weeks. In the first 6 weeks, students receive job skills training on the PB campus. And for the last 6 weeks, students transport to various job sites around San Luis Obispo to take a tour and interview individuals from a variety of businesses in San Luis. This year, 16 students are participating in the program.
Thank you very much for the report. Harley Bonilla from San Luis Obispo High School.
I'm Harley Bonilla. I'm the student congress chair for ASB at San Luis High. Our school year has started off. It's been great so far. And we had our Welcome Back Assembly on September 18th, which is our annual thing that we do at the beginning of every year to say hi to all the students after a long summer, introduce any staff, and this year was really, I can honestly say, I don't think I've seen the students that excited about that assembly during the whole time at high school. So I just think that was really great. ASB tried a new format. We did kind of like a newscasting theme for the assembly. So our athletic commissioners were kind of like newscasting. And then it was fun to do all the sports, introducing them as well. And then Mr. Jones announced that our school once again improved on the STAR test this year. We improved 4 points from 818 to 822, which for the seniors means we get to do the Disneyland trip again in April. So seniors really looking forward to that. It's a great incentive to continue trying hard on the STAR test for all the younger classmen. Upcoming events for October. Yesterday, actually, the parents, senior parents, had the first meeting of the Sober Grad Committee. So parents of the class of 2010 are getting together and already planning a safe and fun grad night for the seniors this year. The school counselors have been going around to junior English classes. They're doing that this month. And they do a career unit type thing where the counselors do an activity. It's a computer activity, and you answer questions. And the website will give you a list of potential career paths that you may be good at. And so that's always really fun to see what's out there for people who might want some extra ideas for what they want to do. Tomorrow in the cafeteria, we're having CSU application night for some extra help getting all the application information for the CSU. Our homecoming week is this month, the 19th through the 23rd. Last Friday, we announced our homecoming court with all the princes and princesses. And Miss Foz is our grand marshal this year. She actually graduated from SLO, and now she teaches American Sign Language, and she's the advisor for Spirit Club, which is brand new this year. The students, a couple students in ASB started it, but it's really grown. A lot of kids just from all grades are getting involved, and it's basically designed to boost school spirit and get people excited about school in general, and particularly sports, and not just football, but sports all year long. We're hoping to get more people to go support in general. We're also trying to get possibly buses to go to away games to show support, you know, not just at home, but everywhere. Our homecoming game is October 23rd at 7:30 versus the Atascadero. So that's always a good game when we play them. So we're really excited for that. Just a couple other things we started this year. ASB started lunchtime rallies in the activity quad on Fridays that we have home games. And so cheer does a dance and a cheer, and the football players go up and the band plays. It's a really good way to showcase the band and give them recognition, but also remind people that there's a game to come support the players, and it's really fun. So that lasts about 15 minutes, and then we play music in the quad. And so it's really a nice thing to do on Fridays, kind of like a little end of the week celebration at lunch. The last big thing that happened for our school so far is our Black and Gold Boosters donated $20,000, and that's just really great of them. Half is going to be used for academics and half for athletics, but the nice thing about it is that it's for things outside of required, like outside of required texts or required materials, and so it can be used for special projects or maybe field trips and supplemental materials that teachers might want for their classes. So the committee is meeting soon to disperse the funds, but that's going to be really nice for the school, especially with budget cuts that are happening. So that's going to kind of provide extracurricular or supplemental things for all the students. So we're really excited about that. So looking forward to homecoming, and it's going to be a busy month.
Okay. Thank you very much. We thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. We're always happy to see you. As always, you have the option to stay and participate if you'd like. On the Santa Lucia Regional Occupational Program Board meeting, Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. It's been quite an honor to continue to serve as the chairman of the ROP. In light of the 45 inches of this agenda, however, I'm going to keep my report extremely short this time. The growth of the number of ROP classes and students continues to grow at such a pace that Jim Souza, the superintendent, and I are sending this letter to the ROP faculty members. On behalf of the Santa Lucia ROP Board of Trustees, I would like to thank you for your continued dedicated service to the high school students. As an educational community, our ROP now serves over 3,000 young people and gives them valuable foundation in career education. I would also like to make you aware that for the 2008-2009 school year, Santa Lucia ROP enrollment exceeded 800 ADA for the first time ever. This represents an increase of over 11% from the 2007-2008 school year. It's just a real testament to the faculty and to the to Jim Souza for what's happening, and this is faculty at all the school districts that are members of the ROP JPA. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Education services, educational services update. Dr. Matakovich.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam President. Lots going on with the start of the school year. I'd like to highlight a few things. We've provided a critical response training to over 30 staff members in conjunction with hospice partners. This training prepares us to handle incidences centered around the grieving process and possible death of a student, parent, teacher, staff member. And I just want to thank Ian Trejo and Jackie Kurt Martinez for coordinating this work with hospice. Also, we're finding that our kids are reading more and more these days. Our comprehensive literacy model, as well as our new homework policy that emphasizes daily reading, has shown great strides with our instructional media center, who to this date has delivered twice as many books as ever before in their whole history. So I want to thank Sharon Hout and her staff for meeting the requests of our classroom teachers. But most importantly, our kids are reading, and we like that. In the area of educational technology, we've completed our 4th through 6th grade teachers program, which has provided additional classroom computers and sets of student response pads. We're happy to report that we've successfully completed this program, and we've been rewarded by the California Department of Ed and they've sent us an additional $56,677 to continue our grant. And hats off to Eric Jarvis, who is really the steward of this competitive grant process, and we want to thank the teachers for participating because their students are benefiting from these additional supports. In the area of adult education, Greg Halfman and Sally Ames are working in conjunction with Tina Lucas, our BITSA coordinator, to provide to our adult ed and career technical ed teachers a program which will allow them to earn a designated subjects credential. This is a wonderful opportunity for our teachers here because the closest program is in Ventura at this time. So we are really grateful to the staff to be working to support our staff locally, and thanks for taking the initiative so more of our teachers can be credentialed easier. In the area of mathematics instruction, we've highlighted for you the development of a K-12 math articulation effort this year. We're going to be engaging our K-12 staff in the process of looking at our trends in mathematics and our student performance data in conjunction with our math adoption as well as the complementary staff development that goes along with the adoption. In preparation for the work with this team, our district staff is doing an analysis of our students' performance in math over time. We know this is an area that we need to deal with seriously, and we anticipate that we'll be able to come back to you in November or the 1st of December with a report that will show you our analysis so we can begin this work in addressing the issues in our math instructional program. So that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Matakovich, I just wanted to ask, the IMC sent out twice as many books as they ever had before, which is fabulous. My question is, some years back, we really cut the IMC staff down to a skeletal group.
Federal legislation, the No Child Left Behind 2001 legislation, requires local school districts to meet adequate yearly progress criteria for individual schools, specific subgroups of students, and school districts as a whole. The criteria that we are to meet are fourfold. One, annual performance index. Two, percentage of students at proficient or advanced levels of achievement. Three, participation rate. And four, graduation rate. Although our district has met three of the criteria, our district did not fully meet the criteria, the second criteria, the percent of students at proficient or advanced level. If the district fails to meet any of these criteria in all of the grades they serve, then the school district is identified as a program improvement. Four of our subgroups did not meet the required percent of proficient or advanced, and you have the results in this item presented for you. So as a district and program improvement, we're required to take corrective action. Our district is instituting new curriculum and professional development for staff in the areas of the comprehensive literacy model, English learners, K-12 math articulation, professional learning communities, and response to intervention. At this time, there's no board action required. This public hearing will provide public testimony on the district's program improvement year 3 status. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll open the public hearing regarding year 3 of program improvement. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in the public hearing? Seeing no one, then the hearing is closed. Okay. Mr. Millar.
Dr. Matakovich, so the percentages that required for proficient and advanced, do those increase again next year? I mean, are we constantly chasing an increasing unattainable percentage?
Yes, I don't recall at this time the percentage for next year, but it does increase, and yes, it will be unattainable.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
Great minds think alike. Thank you, Walter, for asking. Same question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Item 6 is a resolution. Resolution 030910. Yes, I did. Determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. Mrs. Delkus Camp.
This item is a follow-up to the public hearing that we held on September 15th. I want to inform you that I have verified with all schools that all of our students have sufficient textbooks and instructional materials for all of the required curricular areas. Mr. Unger and actually some staff from the County Office of Education provided us with CSBA's update on the resolution. So the resolution you see before you tonight has adopted some new language. It has incorporated the state's decision that there be a hold or a freeze on instructional materials adoptions. The last time that the state formally adopted books was in reading language arts in 2008, but they are not requiring districts at this time to adopt books. They don't say that we can't. They're just not requiring it because of the budget situation that the state and many districts are facing right now. So they're providing that flexibility. And that adoption freeze will go through 2012. It won't be until 2013 that the state will again provide information as far as what requirements for adoption will be needed. And so in these following years, as we bring this item of sufficiency forward, what sufficiency will mean is that what it has always meant, that all students have the textbooks that they need and the instructional materials. But what's added to this resolution also is that should a district decide to adopt at certain grade levels or for certain courses, that adoption needs to be district-wide. And some districts are considering that because to adopt K-12, for example, in reading language arts, runs us about $815,900,000. And so some districts may consider adopting it to adopt and put something into place that can carry on that instruction. But we are being very, very careful and collaborative in our discussions because of the budget situation.
Most of our math adoption was encumbered in the 08-09, and we completed the purchases with some discretionary money in 09-10.
Okay. Catherine?
Thank you. Mrs. Dunkus-Camp, I was just going to ask you to comment on Mr. Bedrigian's two comments, and you've mentioned the one, the precalculus. And could you speak to the comment that the English books are not going to be replaced until 2013 under this resolution?
Well, it's not necessarily that they can't be replaced until then. The state is saying that they're not going to require us to replace them before then. I believe it's really a part of the district discussion as to what the needs are that rise. And so I did talk to principals at different schools about their language arts materials and the condition of them. And the majority of our schools indicated that their language arts books are in good condition. But in at least one, possibly two cases, there was concern. And so although that's not a sufficiency item, it is, you know, something that we deal with and that we have a process for.
Okay. Mr. Angel?
What's the process for encouraging participation from our employees and our employee bargaining units?
Participation in what?
So is the governing board encouraged participation by parents, teachers, members of the community, and bargaining, I guess, just to go through this process of making sure we have adequate materials, because you know, Bruce did raise some concerns.
I believe Mr. Bedrigan's concerns are about the quality of some of the textbooks. But yes, as I said, I contact all of the schools, and so what we do is I contact the principal, and the principals go out and speak with their department heads and the teachers to determine if everybody has sufficient texts and materials. And I know elementary principals do the same thing. They go and they speak with every teacher.
Okay. Mr. Millar?
Just for clarification, Rita, so you can do an adoption just at a certain grade level, but it has to be district-wide for that grade level.
Right. For example, to the north of us, I believe it was at Atascadero Unified School District, who adopted K-5 or K-6 mathematics without adopting for the secondary level. And that's okay, because all those schools and all those grade levels will have adopted in the same adoption year or cycle.
Thank you for clarifying.
Mr. Buckman.
Phil, just to talk to your point just a bit, in today's newspaper there was a short article from another district in the county who talked to this and is inviting the public to attend the hearing we had last time.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Thank you. One part of this resolution talks about having sufficient textbooks for students to use both in class and to take home. And I know that there's often a conversation from parents about having textbooks for children to be able to take home, and then in high school we have these enormous textbooks, so you can possibly take home all five textbooks. And some schools and some classrooms have them in the classroom so the student doesn't have to, and some do not. How does that fit into our sufficiency equation?
This doesn't mean that we have to supply two books per student. That would be a cost that I don't think any district would be able to bear. What it means is that the student has the ability, has a book that they can use in class and that they could take home, because there were some situations before this law came into place where a teacher had a class set and that's what they had, and students couldn't take a book home to do homework because the book had to stay in class for the next group.
But is it fairly and equitably every school and every class, if one group, one class, one level has that to take home and to have in class, is it the same at another school? Are we fair across the board?
No, we're not, because what has happened, a lot of those materials we get for free. So depending on how many books we order.
Dr. Ballantyne.
Yeah, just wanted to add some context to the conversation. The only reason anybody would forego an adoption is because there are higher budget priorities in the organization. I think the board is aware that the restrictions on categorical funds have been lifted. Categorical funds are funds that are designated for a special purpose, and the dollars in the past could only be used for that particular purpose, and instructional materials was one of those categorical funds. As Rita has noted, an adoption of a major subject area like language arts can cost upwards of $800,000-$900,000. What we're trying to do with this flexibility, and I think we're not alone in this, is to stockpile as many resources as we can to continue to staff the programs that we have for children both now and in the future. And we're taking advantage of every opportunity to economize on inanimate objects in order to fund our people who breathe.
Thank you, Dr. Ballantyne. Mr. Moore.
I move approval of resolution 030910.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mr. Unger. Oh, is there anyone from the public who would like to comment on this resolution? Thank you. Mrs. Holmes.
Millar? Aye.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisengrath Rogers?
Aye.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Angel?
Aye.
Passes 6-0.
Okay, item number 7 is also a resolution, resolution number 040910, adoption of 403B tax sheltered annuity plan and governmental 457B deferred compensation plan and designation of Great American Plan Administrators, Inc. as third party administrator. Mr. Miller.
Thank you. The IRS code allows certain governmental employees to participate in two tax sheltered plans, termed the 403B and the 457. The district offers this benefit to our employees. And it has been determined that the most efficient manner of administering to these TSAs, tax sheltered annuities, is through a third-party administrator. The third-party administrator has knowledge of IRS code, investment opportunities, and the laws that govern the 403Bs and the 457s. Previously, our third-party administrator was a firm of Tax Deferred Services. Tax Deferred Services recently went through a reorganization, and we took the opportunity to look at the various third-party administrators that were available to us, and we determined that the district's best interests are served by switching its third-party administration from Tax Deferred Services to Great American Plan Administrators, also known as ZUK or ZUK. And attached is a resolution that authorizes the district to establish compliance and administration procedures to ensure the district's voluntary retirement plans comply with state and federal regulations. Also, a contract as a third-party administrator, Great American Plan Administrators, will assist the district in meeting its responsibilities as a plan sponsor, and finally, require plan participants and investment option providers, the vendors that offer these TSAs, to adhere to the newly established procedures as outlined by the district and the IRS. There will be no cost to the district or to its employees, and we recommend that the board approve Resolution 040910.
Okay, Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Russell, for getting back to me on this. As an employee, as somebody who has had money in TDS, I was glad to hear that we're looking out for the best interests of the district's employees, and this switch seems appropriate. When the time comes, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion, but I know there's other discussion at this point.
Okay. Mr. Buckman.
Yep. Again, I appreciate all the work that's gone into this. I did have one question, and I'm not sure how it works. On the first page, when we go down to fiscal impact, Russell, and I don't know a lot of these companies that work for free, so I'm looking at there will be no cost to the district or its employees. I'm sure there's an explanation, but I'd love to hear it.
There's two ways that they indirectly derive a fiscal benefit out of this relationship. Number one is that within the district, our allocation for 403, I can't imagine, as you can't, that there's a benefit here that they're passing up any benefit that might be there. So those are the two answers that I would have to your inquiry. There might be more. I'm not that familiar with the intricacies of this operation, but those are the two things that occur to me.
Just for fun. So floating money is not part of this problem that we're having with the economy right now?
It might have been the problem that contributed. That's why the financial institutions were caught short.
Okay,
seeing no one else, Mr. Unger?
I move approval of resolution number 0409-10.
Okay, so we have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Buckman. By Mr. Buckman on the float.
Mr. Unger.
Aye.
Mr. Buckman.
Sure.
Dr. Eisengrath Rogers.
Aye.
Mr. Millar.
Aye.
Mrs. Roger.
Yes.
Mr. Angel.
Aye.
Passes 6-0.
Item 8 is approval of revised lease and development agreement with Sheer Edge LLC for Avalos School. Mr. Parker.
Good evening. Since the board entered into the 99-year land lease for the Avalos property with Sheer Edge, there have been a number of changes, as we expected there might be as the Sheer Edge goes through the approval process. What we have for you this evening is a proposed amended agreement which reflects those changes. And in a nutshell, the project is now divided into two phases to allow Sheer Edge to move forward with phase one while giving them time to work with the community for phase two. And phase two includes the old schoolhouse structure, which has been determined to be an historic structure. Staff is recommending an approval of the agreement this evening, and representatives from Sheer Edge are here if you have questions that you would like to ask them.
Thank you. Mr. Unger?
Yeah, I just want to thank Brad Parker and Mr. Miller and for being able to work with Sheer Edge. And then I'd also like to thank the reconstituted Sheer Edge folks for really shepherding this project through and making this dream, which has been going on, I think we said, since about 2004, a reality for our school district and the kids of our school district. I think we're going to be seeing rents at some point after construction of in excess of $80,000 a year plus adjustments for the consumer price index. 99 years, we're talking about millions of dollars. That's going to be unrestricted money for us, and so thank you all very much. I'll move approval of item number 8.
Okay, and I'll second that. So we have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by myself. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously.
Thank you.
And eloquently spoken, Mr. Unger.
Indeed, sir.
Item 9 is follow-up to the board study session on student drug use.
Good evening, board, district members, and students that were here. I have to at least start off saying that I officially now feel older tonight due to the fact that Morro Bay High School is celebrating Dress Like the 90s now. So I'm in that decade. So, yes, I'm officially there. I've been asked tonight to come here and kind of do a little bit of review on the actual session that we had last week. So just kind of a Q&A, I guess, something along those lines. If you had any questions, most of you, I believe, were there. Oh, by the way, I'm Jeff Arguena from Pacific Beach High School, social science teacher. So we can just kind of go with the agenda. And Mary, I knew that there were some questions that you possibly wanted to have answered.
Excuse me for being out of the area while we came to this item. If I could, we have some projection to do, and we'll just take a minute. So I apologize for
So, Jeff, are you doing this because I failed so miserably as the scribe for our group last week?
We're working through it together.
Thanks, Jeff. As we had, as you'll remember, a large number of participants, and I'm very pleased that some of the members of the group could attend this evening tonight.
Should we all get up and go to
the room? We're almost here. So if I may, you brought together students, parents, teachers, counselors, administrators, community members, and public service providers to address your goal. And your goal was you wanted input on four areas. You shaped questions around, Kim, if you would, please. You shaped your goal around what are the indicators How do we early identify our at-risk students? What's our existing protocol? And then what's the evaluation for effectiveness? You have in your board item the results of our discussion. We took each question, Kim, if you remember, you asked us to address the question. Staff provided an answer, which was based on our existing practices. We gave a brief summary. And then we went through table talks where we discussed what's working relative to the question. If so, why? And if not, why not? And you wanted to know what our schools can do, what the district can do, and what the community can do. What I would like to do is to be able to walk through each of the questions, provide a brief summary of the notes that you have in your packet, and then I'd like you, if you would, to comment on that question, because you had the advantage of sitting at tables and listening to a variety of seven different conversations. So there might be some emphasis here that you would like to point out and we'd like to include as we take this information back to the staff. So if that meets with your approval, I'd like to take question number one. What indicators can identify students with drugs, alcohol, or home issues which impact learning? The staff answer had to do with looking at three big indicators: academics, attendance, and behavior. And we felt that by observing these factors, both looking for drastic changes or subtle patterns, that would be a way that we would be able to indicate of students with these issues. From the study session response, what came clear was an emphasis on the student grade history, their attitudes towards school, students feeling a sense of isolation, students with changes in their family, and there was a listing, as you can see in the agenda item, of a number of other reasons. What we talked about in terms of what's working were our student success teams at all of our schools. What's working is our staff connections to build rapport. And what we talked about is what could we do differently to improve. At the school level, training for staff and possibly earlier identifying students. At the district level, we talked about curriculum articulation and drug testing. At the community level, talked about parent involvement, sharing awareness information, and additional sports and extracurricular activities for our students. Those were some of the ideas that came out of question number one. So what did we miss, Board, or were there other areas that you would say you'd like us to emphasize here in this question?
One of the things that we talked about at my table was there are other indicators that other community organizations might have that might be flags for at-risk students. I'm not sure what access we or our community members would have, but some of the things we talked about were students in foster care, for example, students whose parents are incarcerated. Those were some examples that we were given of students that were in an at-risk category that we might otherwise not know about.
Thank you.
One of the community members also brought the sheriff, actually, or deputy sheriff, brought up making sure our staff is trained and up to date on some of the current lingo and what's new out there as far as drugs, what's reoccurring, and just all the trends.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Buckman?
Our table felt the curriculum falls short is starting early enough in the education process, as early as however we're starting, whatever grade we're starting at, articulating the need to have healthy diet, that we start at that same time to make suggestions to children about healthy choices along the lines of tobacco, drug, and alcohol use. Can you talk to us about what you mean by curriculum articulation?
Exactly that. That okay. there's a need for an articulated program that centers around these issues. We have a state-adopted curriculum that centers around decision-making, how to deal with bullying, and that this is an area that we think we can work on in terms of improving our delivery. So the recognize, as you see in the notes, it was recognized as an area of need. Yes.
Certainly. Just to clarify, we have an articulated drug, alcohol, tobacco, and other danger curriculum. It's DARE at sixth grade, it's Project Alert at seventh and eighth, and it's Too Good for Drugs and Violence 9 through 12. So we're not missing any curriculum throughout our district on the dangers of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs.
I think the feedback that we got in reading the notes had to deal with at the elementary level as well. It is to look at this whole package that we put together in terms of dealing with the needs of our kids through the curriculum. So, I think what was asked was that we when talking with the students and when getting feedback from teaching staff is that we need to look at a program. What our program is and how we're delivering it, I think, is the main thing.
May I ask Mrs. Francis
yes.
a question?
Uh-huh.
Because at our table, the students said, and I think it was supported by the teachers at our table as well, that the only way the information is being handed out to our middle school students is in that 10-minute session they have at the beginning of the school at homeroom where assets can be discussed, but there's no part of the actual curriculum for that to be...
Well, that's why I could tell from the comments that there's a lack of confusion and clarity. Project Alert is delivered in 7th and 8th grade science classes. It might not have the marketing, like how many of you are familiar with Project Alert? Okay, we've been doing it 3 or 4 years. DARE is something that we recognize. So our students do receive the dangers of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs in a research-based curriculum in 7th and 8th grade. And again, I don't know if high school teachers say, now this is your Too Good for Drug and Violence lesson. We might not recognize the title, but it is happening.
Okay, Mr. Buckman?
Mary, within your notes, at the bottom of page 9.3, it says, if not, what can we do differently as a school? And one of the comments that's here is it's not a no-tolerance policy, but my recollection at my table was there is a tolerance policy, and it's, you know, you sort of get one strike, and then something happens to you sometimes. And so I don't know if this was recorded differently or came from a different table.
This came from the audience. We had audience feedback as well, so that was a comment that the audience made.
So the other question, and
sure.
A lot of time the all the stickies didn't get up and it wasn't all red, so there was a question at the table about if we're going to have a policy against drugs and these types of things on mm-hmm. campus, then why is there one free ride?
Okay.
Why is there what?
Well, what he's referring to is, you know, when we identify a student who has drug issues, you know, we... refer them to our student assistance program, though there are discipline consequences as well. But there are some districts who suspend or expel a student with the first incident of drug use. We feel that we're a learning environment and we need to work with the families and the students and provide the support in order to help them make better decisions. So that's been our course to date. May I go on to the next question? Or Mr. Millar, would you...
We too at our table had a comment about a mixed message, particularly related to marijuana and the first strike, you know, the first item not resulting in expulsion hearing, and I'm not necessarily sure that's a bad thing, but that comment did come up
yes.
as well. I was struck, and other folks in our group were struck, by the convergence at the secondary level of awareness of danger and increase in use. And it almost seemed as if there wasn't any danger, things I promised I would do. Julie Mamo Vecchius was in our group, and she couldn't be here tonight, but she wanted me to put out an anonymous helpline for students who are observing behaviors in their peer group and want to be able to bring that information forward, but want it to be a way to get help to the student and not a punitive thing. And I just have to comment, I don't believe that our policies are punitive. I believe they're student-based, and we make the best determination we can to do with the student in view of the facts and the circumstances of their particular trouble. I also want to say, as a skeptic of this whole process going forward, that I was inspired and amazed by the folks that we have working with students and trying to help them with drug and alcohol issues, and also the students themselves and their awareness. I just wanted to get that in.
Thank you, Mr. Millar.
I'm sorry, Dr. Matakovich. Yes. We have two more comments.
Oh, excuse me.
Mr. Miller.
This, I guess, fits in the curriculum, so I'll bring it up now. Friday Night Live used to be something that was at the elementary level, and the funding went away. At least that was the understanding at my table. Mm-hmm. And I want to know if that's something we can talk with the coordinators of Friday Night Live to bring back. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
right now it's at the secondary level, and that's certainly
the... I believe it was in sixth grade, at least at Pacheco, according to my table sources. Mm-hmm.
Good input.
Stronger.
One of the interesting things that we talked about was the notion that tobacco is looked at as a really negatively. And over the, it's taken 40 years for us to get there. It's actually over 40 years, 46 years, I think, since the Surgeon General's report came out. And since that time, we've seen a real decline in the use of tobacco. I think it helps that cities like San Luis have tobacco bans. Morro Bay on the beach, things like that. The problem seems to be marijuana, and there seems to be this message that it's okay to smoke pot. It's not okay to smoke cigarettes, but it's okay to smoke pot. And I think that's something that we see in California. That we have the medical marijuana, I think that's going to be a difficult message to get out to kids. It's the same thing of drinking. We're inundated with alcohol ads, and I think what we saw was this tremendous increase in marijuana use and tremendous increase in alcohol as well, and we'll be fighting those outside messages.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see that under district, we also have the drug testing question, and I just wanted to comment that at our table, we were left with sort of a sense of hopelessness from the students. That was pretty much the message was, it's not a problem drinking and using marijuana unless you're doing it during the school week. That in their definition, that was a problem. On the weekend, it's pretty much normal and expected, and there's pretty much very little you can do as an administrator or a parent. But what they did say had worked for them. These were two student athletes at our table, and they said that at the beginning of the school year at both high schools, there was a rumor started that there was going to be drug testing, and that as a result, the students who were involved in the sports stopped using marijuana because they wanted to play their sports, and they wanted to share with us that in their experience, the threat of drug testing had a dampening effect on the use of marijuana during the season.
All right. May we go on to question number
yes,
two?
Please.
What enhances early identification of at-risk students at all grade levels? Our staff answer identified some key areas, meaning that we, go ahead, Kim, respond to student needs, that we train staff, that we have intervention, counseling, and treatment for serious problems, and that there's a continuum of prevention through early identification and through referrals on campus. What we talked about in the session, the big ideas had to do with communication, between students, school, and home, how important it is to have an effective communication system going on. It's important for parents to be involved and to be educated, and even resulting possibly in parenting classes. Talked about distributed instruction, which means in-school programs, curriculum that we've talked about earlier. Those were big trends that came out of most of the groups. When you talked about what could schools do, said teacher education and ways in which to identify students. At the district level,
kind of knowing what's going on with their kids, and I know a lot of the schools that, and teachers and staff have that kind of rapport. But if we could partner with agencies like corrections, parole, I know we already do with juvenile, yeah, and so that all of the things that are happening with our kids, and one of the issues was a couple of students involved in a burglary off campus. So, you know, just making sure we know when things are happening outside the school world, when other agencies become involved, if we could be on their dial-up list so they could give us a heads-up on it.
Okay. And
Mr. Buckley?
Yes, Mr.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Manager. And I think this ties in with what Walter was saying. One of the most exciting things that occurred was having the students – thank you again – having the students at the table with us telling us, and their insistence or repetitive that they hear of things, they have word of mouth, they could probably tell us things we have no idea. And so if there's something that we could do differently, it's how do we continue to engage the students in some kind of discussion that that helps us protect all the students and give all the students the best opportunity to make good decisions. And I have not a clue, but there's got to be a way to do that.
Okay.
The other thing that we talked about is we can't walk past Cal Poly. And at the beginning of school, there was an alcohol-fueled, I think it was possibly another near riot, and concern about that. What kind of message does that send to our students, and then what kind of work could we be doing with Cal Poly, because the Cal Poly students might be acting as role models for our guys. You know, drinking's okay, it's okay to act this way as long as it's a Saturday night. So I think for us to be able to do something with them and send out a consistent message to the youth in our community is going to be really important.
Thank you. Dr. Eisenrath Rogers.
Under coordination of resources, coincidentally, the night after our study session, the City Council was having their study session, and that resulted in some laws that are now being, some ordinances that are now being considered for underage drinking and how to slow that down and partying. My impulse is to, you gave us a book, which I forgot to bring with me, that you handed out that night,
uh-huh.
which has a template for mm-hmm. how we can work together with the community mm-hmm. to address the problem of underage drinking, partying, just keep our kids safe. And mm-hmm. I would heartily recommend that we involve ourselves. I would volunteer myself to be a liaison just to work with the community mm-hmm. To keep our kids safe, to keep our parents informed about how to, you know, you enter high school and all of a sudden your children are different children than you've been raising for the last 16 years. Mm-hmm. And where do you reach out for support? Mm-hmm. How do you connect with other parents who are going through the same thing? And how do you keep those channels of communication open with your kids? And that would be a coordination of resources that I would look forward to hearing from
Good.
About you.
Good.
All right. May we go on to question number 3? All right. What is the existing protocol after the student is identified? How is the protocol applied in each situation? We have, if you would, Kim, thanks. And then on to the protocol. We have three stages, which Julie Mamel-Beckis addressed, that we walk through with our students. And the feedback that we got on this in terms of what can we do differently or what's working here is that there seems to be, if you would, Kim, the next slide, a low fear of consequences that's coming from our students who participated in the conversation. And there also came clear that there's a need for positive role models that are available to our students. So those were two big ideas that seemed to surface out of this item. When asked what the school could do, well, consequences with support was a key feedback area. From the district level, there was a pattern in the notes that talked about more drug and alcohol counseling available on the site. That's from the drug and alcohol therapists headed up by Frank Warren. And then, again, from the community, and outreach resources needed. In other words, what are the available resources in the community that we can use? So that was the feedback on the protocol piece. And if you would, I'd like to have your input.
Walter.
Thank you. It came up at our discussion table. It's the delay between identification and intervention. And
two comments. One, as we look at the typed results here under as a school, the last two bullets are suspension and expulsion aren't always real punishment, but the last one is help being offered. Constant punishment is not enough outreach. Mm-hmm. Goes to an earlier comment. But in response to Walter's asking for a SWAT team, it's not spelled the same. But the SAR process puts students immediately in contact with different agencies out in the community. And so if we look at early intervention and it's a tardy or something like that, and getting them to the SAR, That came up in our group, that the SARB really is made up of a very interesting group of people.
Very good. Comments?
I think the SAFE meetings would do that as well.
I just want to comment about the SARB suggestion. We had a pretty extensive discussion and had a lot of staff and teachers involved with it a few months ago. And the one thing that I remember being told was that the teachers and counselors and staff they didn't want to resort to SARB right off the bat because they wanted the student at the site to work with the student rather than in the SARB process, which could end up with the student being a community school and in a completely different kind of placement. So I'm not sure that that's a good fit, but I'm not sure that it isn't either.
On to question number four. What evaluation exists to determine effectiveness? We have the Healthy Kids Survey. We had additional technical report data. We have our school plans that address school goals and objectives in this area. And then we have our student assistance program, which provides an intervention for our students. So all of these areas are a way in which we take a look at the services that we're providing and how our kids are doing. The evaluating student substance abuse interventions, you know, if I might highlight, you know, we talked earlier about the big three, attendance, grades, and behavior, about the need for early intervention and looking at current use, perception of harm, and peer and parental approval. I want to say that the Healthy Kids Survey results, it gives us a big piece of data that we can use in terms of providing our programs, and from the staff view, that's a big source of information. The feedback we got at the study session was that the kids don't necessarily take the Healthy Kids Survey seriously, okay? What came out is that we have other data available. We have attendance data, graduation rate data, college admissions, SST, our student success team results. We know the effect of poverty on our students. But when we asked about, so what could the school do, we said, well, more training for staff in this area. In terms of the district, is there long-term data that we could gather maybe from our graduates that might assist us, but that there should be a district-wide approach in terms of the data that we're collecting? And from the community, you know, setting a positive example, what's your comment about Cal Poly, and don't let things slip in terms of dealing with them right away. That was a big feeling that came out of the group. So in terms of evaluation, Board, do you have additional comments that you'd like to make?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Buckman.
Surprise. Hi. I think we had, especially on the California Healthy Kids Survey, we had a few students. I don't necessarily know that they speak for all students. The county has invested probably millions of dollars in the Healthy Kids Survey results, and across the state, I'm guessing, maybe in the billions of dollars, but it's definitely in the high hundreds. And so I wouldn't want to just go with several students' remarks on this. However, I'm very much in favor of a broader outreach of collecting data. However, a long time ago, I promised Dr. Valentine that if we looked into this, it wouldn't result in a lot of work on the back of the district, in extra work. And so what I'd like to hear us talk about is it's not the district necessarily that's gathering the extra data, but that we reach out into the community for those resources. One of the community people that attended
has one vehicle, right?
If I could just augment that a little bit, I think that the delay between having data, entering it, and being able to develop reports on it would, I think that there would be more immediate kinds of indicators that we could act on before the actual data system would reflect it.
Things, looking at buddies at the high school and middle school level, just older peers, like a link crew type program for these students to help. Students listen to students more than they're going to listen to adults. In general, more than they're going to listen to adults. So I think that can help them out.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
I'm not sure where you are.
Yeah, I just have a little summary statement, if I could. Okay. So, we've answered your questions. We've gotten additional feedback based on the dialogue that you had at your tables. Just like to highlight some things as a result of the session. We had over 90 participants, all right, all different roles in our school district community. The students provided invaluable insights into the conversation. I think we'd all agree that they are instrumental in providing us their point of view in terms of effectiveness, and we hope to continue to use them as a sounding board. The coordination of community resources is key in this conversation. Parental involvement to whatever level in terms of information that we provide parents, as well as education. Professional development centered around this topic, and we've identified that through the course of this evening. We know that effective instruction in the area of prevention and intervention could help students, all students. And we are a partner with the County Drug and Alcohol Services Department, and the booklet that Dr. Eisendrath Rogers mentioned is a strategy book that comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And this is something that's provided to communities as a resource. And what our community has done, the San Luis Obispo County, they have put together a 5-year plan that's 07 to 012, of which we are involved in because we participate with Drug and Alcohol Services and Friday Night Live, and we are members of a number of their coordinated agencies. But there is a plan here that we are involved in right now, and continuing to partner with this department and continuing to take the research that and the experiences that they've delineated in their plan, I think can only help us as we grow together in this area to address the issues of drug and other alcohol uses. So that is a brief overview of our session. I think your input's been very good. We have members that attended the session whom I think might want to make a comment or two. But this study session proved to be very interesting and informative, and we have a challenge here, and we look forward to your direction. So if I may, if there might be some brief comments from the participants, might they speak?
Certainly. And I would just say I've listened quietly. My group at my table, we were very fortunate to have two student participants at our table, both of whom were very self-possessed and strong and open, and it was really good to have them feel comfortable enough to talk freely with us. I think communication is key. It came up at our table that there seems to be a sort of a lag at middle school. That's where a lot of kids, it's a jumping off spot for a lot of kids. At our table, it was mentioned that the Healthy Kids Survey may contain some flawed data. And we just had very good discussion. We didn't have the opportunity to write much down because we were busy talking and we weren't busy writing. But I would say that of all the tables there, I see 5 of 6 people are here tonight. So my table, I really want to say yay for my table, because we have a good turnout and we were really an excellent group. So if any of you or people from other tables would like to come up and comment, please feel free.
Causes, like Ms. Rodriguez said, books. I've seen the prehistoric books at pre-Cal's using, and it's sad. So some kids were taking it very seriously. Just the same kids that probably weren't at risk, the kids that are getting their A's on their tests, and smoking is the last thing on their mind. Those are probably the kids that were taking it seriously, and honestly, those are the kids that I'm not too concerned about now or in their future. So I know it's a good concept. It's a beautiful concept. Students giving their input, but I think just several students, as you said, throughout the county came and voiced their opinions. But just from Morbid High School alone, I don't hang out with any of the kids that came here. I know them. I have classes with most of them, but none of them were my group of friends, and yet they all said the same thing. And other schools, students from other schools I've never even met before, are voicing the same thing. So it's take that into consideration. So thank you. It was really nice being able to chirp my opinion in this choir of voices that are coming around the school board. So thank you again.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Bedugian.
Mr. Orton is a counselor at Morbay High School, and he asked me to speak and share some observational data with the school board concerning this issue. And there is some unexpected data out there, and it comes in the form of the two serious lockdowns that we had at Morbay High School. Tactical force came in, the police came in, they searched, every student was patted down, every backpack was searched, every locker was cleaned out and examined, and they found no drugs at Morbay High School. And I wanted to share that with you because Mr. Orton wanted to share that with you.
That's me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Mr. Buckman.
I appreciate, Bruce, your comments, especially because I think one of the things that came out on the 29th was some material from the Department of Social Services that showed more than 50% or at 50% of every child referred in a child welfare case came from a situation where there was drugs and alcohol being used. And I really believe that this is a community problem. We don't have classes in how to use drugs. We don't have classes in how to get drunk. Those classes are somewhere off our campuses. So I'm really excited to hear that the drugs weren't there. I think they're out in the community, and I think that's how it's getting here. I have six suggestions and some of them have been addressed, that may come out of this. First of all, I again want to thank the staff. They did a tremendous amount of work to get this ready and prepared. One, I think that, it was up on the board, and I think Dr. Rogers mentioned it, and I think that there needs to be ongoing dialogue between the district and the community and hopefully the students so that it's clear that this is not an issue that's school-related. We just have the kids here, and we can give the tests or we can talk to them, but it's really a community. So one suggestion would be to have some kind of community out of this that's ongoing. Two, the Child Services Network this year is beginning a series of focuses on sections of the California Healthy Kids Survey and things that they're seeing in the community. So this year, the Children's Services Network, which is I don't know all the people, but it includes the one of the vice presidents from the Juvenile Justice Commission, Dr. Crocker, Biz Steinberg, some very important people in our community, Pat Hedges, are going to be only looking at tardies and what's the effect of tardies in our community, and then they're going to go right through the different other sections. I really think it would behoove us to bring an expert on the California Healthy Kids Survey to the community or have a report from them on how that survey. I've heard that talk before, and that talk explains how even if they're goofing around, there's enough checks and balances within the survey to try and glean some information, and it is used in other communities and it's used around the state to a great deal of benefit. Again, how to have continued conversation with the students, I think, is one of the things I walked away with, absolutely critical, because we were sitting there as adults talking and it was a student that would stand up.
Heard from our teens, and I love how honest you were about that. I think whether it's flawed or accurate, we still agree that any underage teen drinking is not going to keep our kids safe. As a parent whose son graduated from this district, I never felt that counselors weren't trained. I never felt that their teachers failed to do their job. That's just my personal opinion. I don't think the school needs to do more. I think we need to support parents or the sober grad night. I agree with Mr. Unger that we're fighting a cultural norm about underage drinking. There's a code of silence. You know, my own son would say, don't tell her anything. Don't tell her anything. You know, we had a police scanner trying to keep our son safe. You know, he's 27. I lowered my standard. I said, here's the deal. Stay alive, don't get arrested, and graduate. I lowered my standards. He's alive. He's healthy. But we fought every step of the way for the secret life of teens. And the teens at our table said, yeah, we'd tell somebody if our friends crossed the line. I said, what's crossing the line? Well, if you drink alone, that's a bad sign. You know, we don't agree. Teens don't agree what crossing the line is. And all of us sitting here, no teen said, you haven't told us the dangers of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. They know the dangers, but all of us sitting here, we were sexually active. Nobody believes they'll get pregnant. We all drink. Nobody believes we'll get a DUI. People don't wear their seatbelt because that's not going to happen to me. I don't think the district or the school needs to spend any more energy on education. I think we need to support parents and recognize that we're fighting a cultural norm. I think we're a hot district, and I want to hear more from teens.
Well, then I'll go since I'm temporarily in charge of the meeting. There's a couple of elephants in the room that, and one of them is some of our students' suppliers are other students. They're slinging, as the term is.
to support their own use and their own purchase. A lot of things are coming to us or coming to our students from the family's own medicine cabinet. And some of the prescription medications will end up with addictions far faster than any of these kids really appreciate, and I think far faster than a lot of adults appreciate. The synthetic heroin pharmaceuticals are synthetic heroin. So if you become addicted and withdrawal, can be sufficiently difficult to get the person hooked on other drugs to try to deal with the withdrawal of the from the addiction on, say, Vicodin or one of those kind of drugs. The easiest way for a kid in our school district to get alcohol is to have an older sibling pull a handle for him, as they like to call it, or you get a homeless guy. So they'll hang around outside grocery stores because they know they can pick up a few bucks. We had a mom at our table. I wish I could remember her name, but it's probably better if I don't. She was so strong. She does drug testing. When her son started driving, he started taking drug tests from her. And you know, I have a problem with school district threatening or getting involved in drug testing. I think we might be able to encourage parents under certain situations to do drug testing on their own kids. You know, if they're brought in for a counseling session and the grades just fell off a cliff and they're cutting classes, you might want to suggest to the parent that, hey, one of the things you should look at maybe is doing a home drug test to see what else might be going on with your student. And I want to put in a plug for teachers. Over my 9 years, we've had some circumstances where teachers really stuck their necks out to identify kids who they thought were high at school and to try to do something about it. And it's not easy. Thing for teachers to do, and I don't think training is the only answer, because there's so much other stuff already going on in their classrooms and everything. Every time we've had that situation arise, I think many of the board members here have gone out of the way to make sure that teacher gets some positive feedback about the courage to do what they did. I kind of agree with your comments that we are fighting a good fight. I think sometimes, even if the efficacy is in question, you got to fight the fight, because the message that communicates is important. Anyway, those are my general comments. I thought, and as I said, I was not an enthusiast for the session, but I thought it was very valuable, and I appreciate Catherine and Mark and Mary supporting it and bringing it forward, and I thought it was very beneficial. Chris.
So my final comment and my question to everybody is, what's next?
Just some other things that I thought of as you guys were talking was DARE through middle school. And even if it's not necessarily the DARE program, if FNL from the high schools could come down and do demonstrations, not necessarily our every 15 minutes program or our Casey's Pledge program, but just any type of thing to show them. And another thing would, to the students who are caught drinking or being drunk on campus, not necessarily possessing alcohol at the time, but within their systems, it'd be nice to, the question is, when have they crossed the line? What is, when they're drinking alone, as was said, or when they're drinking during the school week. But I think it'd be really beneficial to show them in an AA meeting, or to just somebody who's gone through this. Maybe your signs, which you think, oh, no, well, did they only drink, once a day or something? Well, maybe that the guys in the AA meeting are like, well, that's what I did, too. And it shows you, this is real. This isn't just high school. This is your life. You're going to have to keep going. You can't just stop. Student mentoring would be another really beneficial program. I know I've been trying to find, I mentored last year 6th grade girls in a program called Girl Talk, and I've been looking for another mentoring program to do. And I think it'd be really beneficial if it was open to all students. Morba High School has a really very legitimate way of advertising. We have video announcements and just through the college and community. College and Career Center. So I think it'd be really beneficial if we open programs like that up maybe to kids that are in hard spots in their lives or have been through their records, we can see that they may come up to some hard spots in their life. Because middle school is really the time when kids are picking up. You're not just picking up once you're in ninth grade, you're a stoner now. It starts really developing, like, at a very accelerated rate in junior high. So, thanks for listening again.
So, Mr. Unger, you asked the question. We were looking for your input relative to this topic, what you learned, and we shared what we've learned from this session. Our next steps would be in the area of working with principals and their staff. We had all schools represented at the table, so we've all participated in the session as well as thinking about this topic, and just like an opportunity to keep doing our good work and taking some of these ideas and working with the principals and their counselors to work through what we think might be some next steps or program adjustments that we might need to make, but we need a little time to work with this feedback. Yes.
And so when would you anticipate that you'd be able to report back to the board?
Probably February. That would be a reasonable amount of time.
Let me ask just a question, too. Mary, could you include parents in that group with the asking the principals to bring the parents in? What could we do to be helpful to them at all levels, at elementary, middle school, and high school?
We want to continue the dialogue, and we want to go deeper, and we want to look at our participation with our community agencies as well as our existing programs that we have in place at the school site. So we'll come back in February with a response in terms of what we've, how we synthesize this information. Okay,
Dr. Valentine.
Yeah, I think one of the messages that we need to take forward on this is that we want to refine what it is that we are doing. I think we have the right categories of activities. I think we have the right people dedicated to vigilance for this project. What would be useful is to just make that a more concentrated, more focused, more conscious kind of effort on the part of the school district. Now, that said, I think one of the challenges of this particular topic is that there is no end to it, and that at whatever point you do what you do, there is an entire universe of possibilities of things you could do beyond it. And I think one of the things that we need to, I think, wrestle with is what is the balance between what we do as a school and what parents do as a community. When we talk about the idea of drug testing, and this is neither pro nor con, but every parent in our community is capable of drug testing their own child. I don't know why anybody would require us to do it. At the same time, if it's not happening in the community, then there is every reason in the world to say, well, maybe somebody else will do it. On the issue of the California Healthy Kids Survey, I know we were talking about...
Back. Dr. Mintakovich, thank you for the extensive work that you and your staff did pulling together the comments and the ideas that came out of the study session. Moving on to item 10, how to close the achievement gap while maintaining support for advanced learners, San Luis Obispo High School integrated math classes results. Mr. Jones.
Good evening, everyone. Will Jones, principal of San Luis Obispo High School, and I've been asked to provide you with some information tonight about the integrated math classes at San Luis Obispo High School. Happy to do that. I have a PowerPoint that we'll be taking a look at, and we'll kind of leave it on the opening page there for right now. And I have copies of it for you, so I'll distribute those. There's a rather aggressive tiger on the top of the PowerPoint. Don't take that the wrong way, please. That just happens to be the one that we chose. Also here tonight is Steve Boaz, a member of our math department at San Luis High School. And also I'll put a plug in for Steve, also one of the more exceptional cross-country and track coaches in the state of California. So happy to have him here tonight representing the department. Just some brief context for this conversation. First of all, embedded math, integrated math, combined math, they're kind of all synonyms for the same idea, and that is to have both honors and college prep students combined in the same classroom. And to provide some context for San Luis Obispo High School, for several years at our school, we've been kind of puzzled by, and we've wrestled with conflicting data about the success of our math program. On the one hand, we have had what I use the term subpar results on our STAR testing, which is Algebra 1, Algebra 2, Geometry, and Summative Math for students taking math classes in grades 9 through 11. While on the other hand, we've had enjoyed excellent results on other tests like SATs, ACT, and AP tests. For example, on the SAT, our school average score is a 25.2. In the state of California, it's a 22.8. On the SATs, our score's average is 565, while statewide it's 513, and nationally it's 515. In our AP calculus class, we've had 88% of the students who took the test last year pass the test, and 72% of those students had fives and fours, which are the highest scores you can earn. So we've had this kind of split between the results, which has puzzled us and kind of challenged us over the last few years. We've worked long and hard to address our concerns about the STAR test results, and which led us to take a serious look at the idea of embedding or combining honors and college prep students in Geometry and Algebra 2, a program which has been used successfully, by the way, at Morro Bay High School for several years, and we did some consulting with them and collaborating with them on making the decision. So that just provides some brief context, and I'll try to move quickly through the PowerPoint to give you some more information. So what were the expected outcomes? That we would provide a positive heterogeneous environment that would improve overall student achievement, honors and college prep students, that would help us to more accurately identify honor students. And I can elaborate on any of these points if you'd like later on or now. Just ask me and I'll pause. Flexibility in scheduling. Briefly on that, the more sections there are of a subject, the easier it is for the students to schedule into those classes. So more sections, particularly for honor students. And then improved CST results or STAR test results.
Well, as far as the positive heterogeneous environment, what is the aspect of that that's a positive outcome? Is it the support of advanced learners in a
Correct.
Combined class, or is it curriculum delivery is easier when you've got a classroom of advanced learners?
Well, in this, with the number of sections that we probably had anywhere from 5 to 8 advanced learners or honor students in each section. So still the balance of students were in the college prep category. So, but the presence of the honor students in that class, we hoped, would have a positive impact on the overall environment.
Thank you.
So that keeps the door open for avid students and students who aren't typically identified as honors but can probably cut it.
Correct. And, well, of course, this is the first year we've had AVID, but if we keep this program with the combined classes in our Algebra 2 and Geometry, then, yes, that would benefit, I think, the AVID students. Some of the challenges we had is differentiation in classroom instruction and homework and assessments. If you have combined honors and college prep students, then you have to provide some differentiation. This month we have Brad Fulton coming in from California, who's an expert on engagement strategies in the classroom, strategies in any classroom, but particularly in math, that will help keep students engaged and kind of build their passion for learning mathematics. The results, we're hoping again to look at the learning environment, accurate identification of honor students, flexibility in scheduling, and CST scores, and that's what we'll look at right now, those different things. On the learning environment, college prep students liked help from the honor students. Who wouldn't? If math isn't your strong suit, having that opportunity to collaborate with stronger math students is going to help. Students liked the, this was all from surveys of the students, by the way. They liked the work and the interaction with everyone, no segregation of honors and college prep. College prep students can try honors problems. I mean, those problems are being worked in class, and also they're available for homework. So that gives the college prep students that opportunity. Ease of schedule change. If a honors student decides that I'm really not up to this challenge, they don't have to change schedules and move out of the class. They just go to the teacher and say, you know, Mr. Boas, I would prefer to just be part of the college prep program rather than the honors program. And it did come up throughout the year, though, that and we worked on this, the need for more direct instruction for honor students. And we expected there would be things that would be obstacles that we would have to work on, and that came through, and we worked on that last year, and I think we had success with that. For the accurate identification of honors students and flexibility in scheduling, there wasn't that much movement in Algebra 2. Seven students switched from honors to regular or college prep. In geometry, two students switched from honors to regular.
Well, those figures from the previous slide,
yeah.
Would be more meaningful if I knew approximately how many students were enrolled.
Right, you're going to see numbers of student enrollment. And there was some switching the other way, too. We had some students who went from the regular program into the honors program when they saw that, oh, these problems aren't that much more difficult. I can handle the additional problems or difficulty of the problems on the tests or on the homework. So we had some fluidity in both those directions. What I'm going to share with you now, then, is just some data from the testing, and it'll take a second to get oriented. But if you look at the top, you'll see 2008, all Algebra 2 students, that's all students who, whether they were college prep or honors, and it shows you the average mean scaled score for all students, which is a 328. This is on the STAR testing or CST tests, and the average proficiency level of a 3.0. It shows you a distribution of advanced, proficient, basic, below basic, and far below basic students. And we're talking about 271 students. Probably the easiest number to focus on for our comparison would be the 328 mean scaled score. So that's for 2008 when we had segregated classes, if you will, in Algebra 2. In 2009, we had all embedded Algebra 2 students, and you can see that the average mean scaled score was a 319. Again, you compare that with the previous slide, and you'll note that there was in 2009, there was a decline in that average mean scaled score. So that's data that we have. Again, how do we analyze that data? What does it tell us? It's hard to say when you're only in the first year of a program, but that has to do with all Algebra 2 students, comparing the 2 years. For non-honors Algebra 2, the average mean scaled score was a 298, and you can see that distribution and the number of students who participated. That was in 2008. In 2009, the average mean scaled score was 297, so there really wasn't much of a difference in those 2 years. With roughly the same number of students who were taking the test. And if you look at the honors students, in 2008, the average mean scaled score was a 371, and you had 113 students who were in the separate honors classes. In 2009, it was 361, so it was a 10-point difference. The proficiency level was 350, so you had there was a change in the result, the mean scaled score, but it was still 10 points or more above the on average in the proficiency range on the STAR tests. So that's a little bit about, and I'm going fast through this, but that's some information regarding the combined classes in the Algebra 2, and we'll take a look next at geometry. The average mean scaled score for all geometry students in 2008 was 320, and in 2009 it was 321, so virtually no change. So in that respect, we were hoping that we would see an improvement in the scores. But as you can see with the Algebra 2, that wasn't the case. And at least so far, looking at these results, you see it's about the same. For non-honors geometry students, the average mean scale score is 304. And actually, in 2009, there was an improvement, too, and that would make us feel as if it's not a good idea to continue, then we could, we could dismantle it and go back to the old system. But I think it's truthfully talking about combined or integrated math is really part of a bigger discussion about mathematics in general. And so, you know, we put a lot of time and effort into this program. I think that we're doing the same thing with math in general. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. And Mr. Boaz is here also to answer questions representing his department.
I was just going to ask if we could get some feedback from Mr. Boaz.
I think our department's feeling at this point is that there's some benefits to having the embedded honors program, but it's not working as well as we'd like, and so we're addressing or discussing the why not. I think the advantages that I see personally in having an embedded honors program is the level and quality of work in the classroom comes up. I think the challenge is in providing the same level of difficulty, the same rigor to the honor students. And we've discussed that and how to make sure that the honor students are engaged in more challenging problems and getting their instruction in that more challenging level. I think that the discussions we've had recently, we want to continue. And to be honest, our department isn't sold one way or the other.
Mr. Boaz, how do you explain that the STAR tests that are sort of subpar, as Mr. Jones said, and then those same honor students go on to do so well in the higher level math program?
My personal opinion?
Yes, please.
Has nothing to do with what's happening in the classroom. We accelerate math students. We don't accelerate any other subject area. So we'll have our brightest students taking honors pre-calculus as freshmen, and they don't test in the freshman level like they would in another subject area. Our next level is taking Algebra 2. And if you look at our numbers of students who take Algebra and Geometry as freshmen compared to other schools and other districts, we have far more students who are taking Geometry and less taking Algebra. So they're accelerating through, and if I think that our top students should accelerate, but I think it's that middle group that might be accelerating too quickly. And if they were coming in from middle school, if more students were taking algebra and making sure that foundation of algebra was at a higher level, that would bring the algebra scores up, and then in turn the geometry scores and the algebra 2 scores.
This embedded program will help that?
I don't think the embedded program has any effect on that one way or the other. I think it has to do with identifying students as they come into the high school as to an appropriate level.
We saw the STAR test results, but you guys obviously do teacher-made tests in your classrooms, and I'm assuming you guys have some kind of benchmark testing throughout the year. Are you seeing different results on those indicators than maybe you'd be seeing on the CSTs?
What I see personally, and I have a limited experience with the embedded honors classes. I have the pre-calculus classes, and then I have, which has a standalone honors program. But I have one geometry this year. I had two last year with the embedded program. What I see is the work that takes place in class, I would say, is at a higher level in general. If I look at test scores, the benchmark tests, I don't have enough data to really compare. I don't think we've had the program long enough to see that there's a difference. The general opinion of our department is you see a leveling effect, that you're right now the honor students probably aren't being challenged enough, but it is bringing up the rest of the students. And that was kind of the hope, that this would happen, but we're still struggling with challenging those top students enough. And we've had discussions about how to do that and how to engage those students and give them enough instruction in those more challenging problems. Thank you.
Okay, then one last question.
Yeah, so Mr. Jones, you'll continue to collect data this year, and you'll go through the same process, and we'll hear back from you at the end of this school year, maybe, to see how this is going?
Ninth grade as opposed to in the eighth grade, and, or geometry in the ninth grade as opposed to in the 10th grade. And, it's a different kind of conversation, but there's some pretty interesting data coming out of that kind of research that I've been doing as well.
Okay. Dr. Valentine.
Well, I just want to say I want to echo something Will said. I think there's a larger conversation about mathematics that maybe even a higher priority than taking a look at this. I think that when we look at the structures of various programs, sometimes it's a diversion of our energy away from what really are the effective best practices in mathematics, regardless of the structure that they occur in. And I think those are going to be the profitable discussions that we have. I think you can find in almost any structure folks who are succeeding within that structure and folks who are not succeeding. And the explanation doesn't lie in the structure, but in what happens inside of that structure, I guess.
Well, I think that when we do our next strategic plan review, that we should have this broader conversation about math scores and maybe look at, do we want to do a board goal to close that gap in math scores, too.
Okay.
Thanks, Will.
Mr. Jones, thank you very much.
Sure.
And Mr. Boaz. Item 11 is approval of revised board policy 5145.12, students, search and seizure. This is a first reading. Dr. Matakovich.
Yes, we want to thank the board for suggesting that we talk with our legal counsel, and what you have is a revised policy with the input from CSBA, your organization, as well as our legal counsel. Mainly the guiding principle is that school staff conduct searches when there's a reasonable suspicion that the search will uncover evidence that the student is violating the law, board policy, administrative regs, or other rules of the district or of the school. And so we present this revised policy for your review and consideration, and look forward to your input. This is a first reading.
You have input. Mr. Millar.
I had an opportunity to discuss this a little bit with Dr. Valentine. In that second paragraph under individual searches, the use of the term district property under a student's control is a little troubling for me, partly because I don't know that a school property is ever really under students' control. I think the use of the term control here relates to a series of search and seizure cases over the years where control means within reach, where a student might be able to place something. So for me, it's a little bit unclear. I'm not sure exactly what we would do with it.
Okay.
Then also in the bottom of the page, unannounced search, the student does not have a privacy interest in lockers, desk, or district-owned computers, nor an expectation of privacy when using those things. So it concerns me that later in that paragraph we are tying the search to reasonable cause or reasonable suspicion. When we have a right to search, when there is no expectation of privacy and the district has the right to search, it's unnecessary to tie it to reasonable suspicion, I believe. And I think we should check that with our legal folks. Let's see.
Thank you.
I found it a little confusing that cyberbullying ended up in that top paragraph on the second page.
and I just thought it was clunky. It wasn't really something. I mean, I guess I understand what we're trying to get at, but you know, searching a student's cell phone, there is an expectation of privacy on some level, and I don't know the legal details. I haven't been in criminal law for a while, but some of the information on a cell phone might be construed as private, as a right to privacy issue for the student. And I know we're trying to get our heads around cyberbullying and how we go about doing that, but I think that maybe we should seek some more clinical suspicion. Has got a lot of case law that essentially establishes what it is. It's a much lower level than probable cause or reasonable cause.
Paragraph 4 on 11.2, it is the preferred practice that searches of individual students be conducted in the presence of at least two district employees. Larger or more importantly than the preferred practice, in my opinion, I think it should be absolutely required that there be two employees there, both for the protection of the student and the employee. Tell you why?
No, I understand that. We talk about district employees, but would it be necessary to have two district employees if, say, we had a district employee and a police officer?
That could be written in that it could be a police officer.
Well,
I just think it puts the student in an awkward position, and I don't want to see any student in that position of a search with only one person, and it also puts the employee in an awkward position.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that, and I think that's why it would be absolutely preferable to have two people present, and if humanly possible, it should absolutely be done with two people present. I think we would want the opportunity of student safety and so forth were at stake and an immediate search had to take place to have the liberty to override that in extraordinary circumstances.
Are we talking about search and seizure? Let me go back. I'm thinking search and seizure for drugs. Are we talking about incendiary devices and other
such
items?
Yeah, I think
items?
It's any kind of search or seizure. But I have to concur. If there are two people possible to participate in a search, I would absolutely want our folks to use two people. It's just that there might be an occasion where that wasn't possible and yet still necessary.
Okay, I see what you're saying there. And just for opinion of one person here, the use of drug or contraband detection dogs, for my part, I would only approve the use of dogs in the event that they were required to sniff out bombs or other things. I'm not in favor of bringing drug dogs onto campus to sniff out drugs or alcohol. Yes, please.
I just say that from a general principle, we try to draft board policies so that it is less restrictive. So I agree with Dr. Valentine's comments and your concern about having two employees present, but I do think the flexibility needs to be there for staff if that's not something they can arrange and they feel that they're exigent circumstances. And I think Mr. Buckman's point about reasonable suspicion in the ARs is it probably does need to be set forward and kind of defined in the ARs.
Mr. Buckman.
And Marilyn, just for the sake of discussion on the of the use of dogs, the way I read this is it never requires us to bring the dogs in, but it does leave the door open. So if we had a situation where things were getting out of control or somebody said that drugs have been thrown somewhere, the use of dogs may allow us to find things, and I think I don't think this is just only. I don't think this only refers to drugs. And so, oftentimes in a bomb search, the drugs are really important. So I think where it doesn't say shall anywhere.
Wait a minute, I didn't follow. Oftentimes in a bomb search, the drugs are really important.
Sorry, starts with a D.
Oh, the dogs.
Dogs.
Okay.
Sorry, getting late. So I think the dogs. I'd rather not close the door on them, and since this isn't, it's not requiring, it's not setting up a schedule. It just says if necessary.
I'm not closing the door on. I'm not in favor of closing the door. Good. In the case of a school-wide threat of some kind of threat of violence. I'm just not in favor of using the dogs to detect drugs or alcohol.
Okay.
So we leave the doggy door open or closed?
I just couldn't.
And who cleans up afterwards?
I do have one other.
No, I know where you were. It's okay. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, this is a first reading then.
Thank you.
And this board policy will come back, I guess, the next meeting?
Yes, ma'am.
On consent? Item 12, clarification on whether to agendize board suggested topic, extended day activities for middle school. Catherine, I think that was yours.
Thank you. I'm sorry that John Spadafore couldn't be here tonight since he seconded this, but I'll try to speak for both of us here. You know, we had item 5 today, which talked about the program improvement status that we're in. In an effort to change that, we need to reach our EL students, our socioeconomically disadvantaged students, our non-Anglo students, in a way that engages them and makes them love coming to school and learning. And research shows that the more time kids at risk spend at a school setting with adults that they can role model after, the more they identify and find pleasure in being at school, and the more they're apt to learn and improve their skills. We also learned tonight in item 11, I think it was, about our honor students in high school. Today was the topic, and how they have a need to be stimulated above and beyond what they can get in the average classroom. And what I see that we have here is an opportunity to bring two at-risk groups together, including kids in the middle and the whole range of this, to expand their experiences at school, to expand their peer groups so that they're learning and mentoring each other, that they're in this environment that's similar to an embedded classroom. They're getting the kinds of enrichment that causes a child to connect to their school setting, to learn more, and to do better in school. I think this qualifies for stimulus money because we would be reaching these groups that we need to reach through program improvement. And I think we've identified that middle school is a time when kids are most at risk for becoming bored, getting into trouble, not having enough to do after school, getting involved in drugs and alcohol, and these programs would keep them busy. And for those parents who are so socioeconomically disadvantaged, it gives them the opportunity to have an after-program school for their child that they may not be able to afford on their own. So for all those reasons, I hope that we can ask staff to come back to us with ideas for how we could add such programs as after-school language clubs, after-school math clubs, digital media arts programs, plays, choirs, orchestra, chess, engineering, Odyssey of the Mind, all those kinds of programs that we have had in the past, but we've had to do away with because we haven't had the staff to organize them. And along with this would have to come some suggestion of how we would pay for that out of the stimulus monies, whether that would be a paraeducator, a stipend for a teacher, a teacher on special assignment, members of the community we would hire. That would have to be part of our proposal.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
I need to support Catherine in this 100%, and I'm going to look at another agenda item that was tonight, and that was the results of the September 29th study session where we heard, I think, loud and clear that students want to be engaged, that they need more opportunities to be mentored, and they need to find that one adult that can make a difference in their life. And I think in an after-school program we're setting up the opportunity for that to continue to happen. I say this somewhat facetiously. The governor proposed, I can't remember the number of the proposition, where he set aside money. It can't be used for anything else except after-school programs. Though he's changed his mind on everybody else's, that money may be available to us. I'm not sure. So there may be a funding mechanism for these extended days out of that proposition.
Mr. Unger.
I'll support that as well, but with a caveat that we really need to look at where the money would come from. I'm very concerned about that. I think we already have commitments for the stimulus money. I agree with both your and Mark's rationales. I think this is going to come down to some choices we have to make, and that for me would be the discussion, not whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but what other things are important for us as well.
Mr. Angel.
This after-school program support what the Secretary of Education, Arnie Duncan, wants of our schools, and that's for these schools not to be closed at 3 o'clock.
Decision and a philosophical one about when we feel our school day responsibilities end. And I would like to thank Mrs. Frost and Mr. Elfrank for staying with us till 10 o'clock at night, and perhaps they'd like to contribute to this conversation since they're here and they're the principals of our middle schools.
We're certainly happy to answer any questions that you might have. You saw in our presentation a couple of weeks ago that we have offerings for our students after school, but not the rich offerings that maybe Dr. Eisendrath Rogers describes. And our kids could benefit from more offerings. What we haven't had time to do is talk to our teachers, maybe about what priorities might be after school, or even talk to the students, maybe do a student survey. If given the opportunity, what would an after-school program look like for you that you would be interested in participating in?
I would agree wholeheartedly. It's really looking at getting that student input. I think we can intuitively feel, much like what you guys are saying, that as we extend the day and have more engaging activities after school, clubs and those types of things, I think a lot of the other issues that you had identified already in previous board items will impact them. But it's the resources, the budget, which is the question. But I would also agree, I'm not too sure it's a site decision in regard to having equitable programs and really making the support of the board saying this is what our middle school programs really need to have.
May I make a motion?
Yes.
May I make a motion? Okay.
Yes.
I would like to move that we direct staff to come back to us with a proposal for after-school programs at our middle schools with suggestions for funding and for staffing.
With suggestions for funding and, I'm sorry?
Included in that proposal, suggestions for funding the program, the after-school programs, and for staffing the after-school programs.
Okay, so...
some discussion.
Mr. Unger?
And would that also include, as Dr. Elfrick and Mrs. Frost have suggested, talking to the teachers and the school and the students and the parents about what something like that might look at on each particular site?
Yes, but I go back to the comment that about was a site-based decision, and I'll just add this, that I know at the elementary school level, for example, that is a site-based decision, and it's dependent then upon the parents that are at the school that particular year and whether they can direct plays and whether they can teach chess. And, you know, so it becomes very dependent upon the parents and the students that happen to be cycling through that school at that time. And also, one school may have an abundance of after-school programs because they have a riches of those parents, and another school may not. So I'd like to see us come up with some uniformity. It doesn't have to be identical, but just the notion that we support these ideas for the two school sites. I guess I'd want your input on that, but I think we should look at it as a board, which kinds of, at a minimum, what do we want our students to have, and then some individuality between the schools.
Okay, I'm not sure how I feel about this item. I do believe that kids in middle school are highly at risk. I mean, I think that's come clear. On the other hand, I also believe that we have committed our funds a number of ways, and I don't know exactly what the funding mechanism for this would be. And I don't know that it's really the responsibility of the board to be structuring the program. I think if, as a board, if we say we feel middle school students are at risk and we want to look at opportunities to engage them, then that gives staff the opportunity to come back with to their ideas and to come up with something that they think might be workable. This, the way we've structured it here tonight, might be a little too micromanaging for me, but I do agree that middle school students are at risk, and I'm willing to look at ideas for how they can be engaged.
I'm happy to amend my proposal to use the language that you used, because I believe in spirit they're the same, and I think what you just said...
I can't remember what I said, Catherine.
I think I remember.
That in isolation, or how do you evaluate that in context of other ideas and other needs within the school district? And the whole concept of strategic planning is kind of hinges on the notion that there may be more good ideas than a school district can implement at any one point in time, and therefore to go for them one at a time in sequence as they come forward, as opposed to looking at collections of ideas evaluating what are the top priorities among those collections, is a struggle, I think, that all school districts have. One possibility, and I put it out there, and board, do with it obviously what you will, would be to embed this in the larger context of strategic planning and see where it rises in that discussion. And I hope it rises high, actually.
Mr. Buckman?
Yeah. I'm maybe misunderstanding, but I think the motion is only asking staff to basically explore this concept and not come back. I mean, I'm not sure the board will take action. I'm not sure it would come back as an action item. And I'm just not seeing the harm in having this discussion at the board level, rather than waiting till we get to the strategic budget.
I don't have any objection to that line of thought. I think at the point at which the ultimate decision is made to commit staffing and funding, how would that best happen? But to talk about how it could happen can happen any time the board chooses.
Mr. Millar?
Well, I think our normal protocol is majority vote to put the item on the agenda, and then the next step is to refine what the agenda item is going to consist of when it comes back to the board.
Take a vote.
Yes, it is. So I guess I would say that given everything that staff already has on their plate, I would expect that it will take some time to formulate these ideas and discuss these concepts with the stakeholders, being the teachers, the principals, whatever. So I would like to ask Dr. Matakovich what she thinks might be really a reasonable length of time before this item could come back.
Mm-hmm.
was on. Excuse me. Oh, am I on? Excuse me. I think that I'd like to meet with the principals and kind of map out what our approach would be to this item, and I think it would take us a minimum of 2 months to put it together, given the fact that you're asking us to work with our parent community, our students, and our staff.
So then would we be thinking, let's shoot October, November, for it to come back?
December.
Don't we? I think we do. December is largely gone because of the holidays.
We choose for the first meeting in December.
How about we give you the second meeting in January?
Okay, that's fine. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm just suggesting if this motion passes, it could be the second meeting in January. We have a motion on the table from Dr. Eisendrath Rogers with a second by Mr. Buckman. Those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. So that passes 4-2. Okay. We're moving on to the action consent agenda, so please let me know if you would like any of these items to be pulled. Item 13, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 14, approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization.
Please pull.
Item 15, acceptance of donations. 16, disposition of surplus property. 17, approval of purchase orders. 18, approval of warrants and payroll. 19, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement. Item 20, approval of out-of-state field trip, Morro Bay High School FFA to National Convention in Indianapolis. Item 21, approval of revised board policy 5131, students' conduct.
Yeah, please pull.
Item 22, approval of revised board policy 5137, students' positive school climate. Item 23, approval of authorization. Mr. Buckman.
Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi. Actually, the main reason I'm asking us to look at this individually is because I'm a little worried if the public were to take a look at this and start looking down the number of teachers that are working outside of the credentialed areas. And some of these that look single subject agriculture intro to science is going to be teaching speech. Just some of them seem a little single subject Latin is teaching health and family living. So my main concern is there's Ed Code that allows all this, but it could just be look like an awful lot of teachers teaching out of their credential.
Yeah, we actually have five different sections of Ed Code and then the California Code of Regulations that allow this. And in all situations, we try to review them carefully and make sure that either the staff member has the upper division units, what might be the equivalent of a minor in the subject area or under the California Code, an area that actually does not have any credential associated with it. And, sometimes the fits don't seem, absolutely accurate or necessary. But for the example, the ag teacher that's teaching speech, there probably is no better person on the SLO High campus to do that because those individuals involved with FFA spend much of their time in parliamentary procedure and speech and debate. And so we feel this is a highly qualified teacher. All of these are fully credentialed teachers, and they're all vetted per Ed Code. But I can discuss it without names of individuals, even though they're in the board item. Specifics if you care to.
Rick, have any of these teachers taught in their out of credentialed areas before?
Yes.
How many years, generally?
Some of them for many years.
I move to go ahead and approve item 14.
Second.
We have a motion by Mr. Beckman, seconded by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Item 21, approval of revised board policy 5131, students' conduct. I think, Mr. Angel?
I was looking at item on page 21-4, where it says possession of cellular phones and other electronic signaling devices. I noticed we took out the device may be held until a parent conference occurs, and I'm not sure if that was something we wanted to take out as a board or just discuss.
I think that was...
Yes.
I believe that was my suggestion, and it revolved around the safety of the student after school. I think a lot of parents are relying now on cell contact with their children, and I know as a parent I would have been concerned that my child may have been sent home or walking home or in a situation where they didn't have access, and I think the parent conference can occur at a later time without endangering the child.
Does this tie the hands of our administrators to take a phone for our repeat offenders?
I think it allows our administrators to make contact with the parent, which is what is a key factor here. They want to work with the family to ensure that this device is used properly and not improperly. So this language is fine with the administrative staff.
Okay.
I'll move for approval of item 21.
And I'll second. So we have a motion by Mr. Angel and a second by myself. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. No. Opposed?
No.
You are opposed?
I just don't think it has enough teeth, but that's fine.
Okay, so we have five in favor and one opposed. Advance agenda. Okay, don't see any advance agenda.
I actually do.
Okay.
I have two. We did get a report from the administration on my request for more information on residence checks. I'd like to advance that through the process, and I'd like to bring that back to see if that's something that the board has an interest in discussing. And then the second thing is that... CARS, the California Association of Resource Specialists and other special educators, has declared December 3rd as Day of the Special Educator, and I'd like us to examine whether that's something we as a board would like to recognize. So I'm not sure where to go with the first one.
I think that means what we will skip is the step of a clarification topic to further expand. So we'll just bring a resolution.
Okay.
And Dr. Valentine, what I'll do is... I'll contact CARS and have a sample resolution sent over to you so that you can examine that and make sure that it's something that actually we'd like to do.
I was actually referring to the fraudulent address item. And my understanding was that it actually had been supported to some degree prior to this. We used the update to prime the pump. The question I have for the board is, shall we just bring it back as an item, or do you want a defense of the item?
I could see bringing that back as well.
Okay. How do we feel? Do we want it to come back as an item, or do we want to have a rationalization for it to come back?
Item.
Are you ready to have it come back?
I would like it to come back.
Walter? Well, yes, we do. We have a consensus. Okay, and if there aren't, Mr. Angel.
Sorry. I would like to ask for support to invite the county assessor to a meeting early next year when we begin the budgeting process. He's expressed interest.
Has expressed interest in attending our meeting?
And actually presenting and actually presenting to the board about what goes on with assessments and whatnot.
Phil, what month were you suggesting?
He was saying after in January or maybe a little later when we do our budgeting process or right before we budget.
Okay, do we have board support for that? Does that need to come back? Or?
Well, I mean, is he going to tell us how the system works, or is he going to tell us how much money we're going to get? And what's he going to tell us?
I can't read his mind, Walter.
I'm asking.
I think he just wants to go over the whole process and where he fits and where we fit in that.
Fascinating.
I see no harm. So we have at least four. We'll just schedule it at Mr. Bordenaro's convenience sometime in early spring.
I'm sure this is a motion that brings an agenda item forward, so we need to second and then it needs justification.
Right.
Unless you have consent.
But if we have a majority of the board approving it on its face, then it doesn't have to come back for the persuasive.
I didn't realize you have consensus at this point.
Well, you agreed to it, and Catherine, you did not.
Definitely not.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
I totally misunderstood. I thought I saw that you were indicating yes. Okay.
I'm supporting.
You are supporting it. Okay, then it is coming back for defense. If there are no additional items, the hour is late. We are adjourned. Oh my God! I forgot board reports.
So are you?
Did you have a board report?
Inches from a clean getaway.
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's a report. I mean, it's a educational.
I really apologize.
This, discussion on the Johnson Avenue project is my report, but I can wait till next time.
Discussion on Johnson Avenue? Oh, on the community?
The community.
Can you do it next time?